imagine traditionally you're a structural engineer, you're thinking, how do we get from, say, for a bridge from point A to point B? And the sort of questions you ask might be, what's the most effective way to get there? What's the safest way to get there? What can we replicate that's been done before and has worked? Whereas a humanitarian engineer might look at that problem of how do you get from point A to point B and ask a very different set of questions. So they might say, who's going on this journey and where are they going? And are they going into a new community? Are those communities connected? And then the actual construction itself, is this a chance to try something new, to test some sustainable innovation? Is it a way to bring people together to help local employment? It's really, I guess, a way of broadening the scope of the problem on paper you think you're solving and looking at defining that on a community level.
Hi, Smart Community friends. In this episode, I have a great chat with return guest, Jess Coldry. Now, we first had Jess on the podcast back in episode 258, which was released in October of 2021. But more recently, we reshared that episode as part of our summer series, and we promised to have Jess back on the show for an update. So here she is. In this episode of the Smart Community podcast, Jess and I talk about what she's been up to in the last 18 months, including doing her Masters of Humanitarian Engineering in the UK. She tells us what humanitarian engineering is and what a smart community means to her. We discuss the power of having different experiences and disciplines involved in projects because it leads to asking a different set of questions and why we should be shifting to a more community-led project design approach. Jess then tells us about her work in endometriosis advocacy, including becoming a laureate of the Australian-French Association for Innovation and Research. We finish our chat discussing the emerging trend of the role of AI, so artificial intelligence, and machine learning in art and how that influences work more broadly, including what we do with our time as more and more things become automated. As always, we hope you enjoy this episode as much as we enjoyed making it.
Welcome to the smart community, smart regions, smart towns, and smart cities. It's where we live, work, and play. With smart communities, the future starts today. Big data, smart mobility, emerging trends galore. The Smart Community Podcast is what you're looking for.
Hello, Jess, and welcome back to the Smart Community Podcast. I'm so excited to have you.
Hi, Zoe. Nice to be here. Be nice to catch up again.
I know. I'm so excited to hear about what you've been up to. We were just having a look. So your episode was released in October of 2021, which feels like a very long time ago, but also not that long ago. I don't know, this weird paradox that we live in. Yeah, it's a time warp for sure. First of all, you were on our summer series, so we're excited to have you back again, because I re-listened to that episode. I just love that conversation we had, and something I've been thinking and plotting on how we can do more with art and smart communities and all those type of things as well, now that we're hopefully kind of coming out the other end of a pandemic, which we know is still happening around the world, but hopefully we can, you know, continue to kind of bring in new ideas and things now that we're lifting out into some kind of, you know, new reality. But let's first, I'll go to you, and can you tell us your background and what you are passionate about?
Sure. So I have a very multidisciplinary background. I have a degree in visual arts, human geography, and humanitarian engineering. So I suppose I really am just captivated by how many different perspectives you can bring to a problem. So whether you're looking as an environmentalist or a sculptor or an engineer, how would you look at, you know, solving water crises or food crises? And I think a lot of the work I do more broadly focuses around the Sustainable Development Goals, but I'm always looking for, I suppose, a new perspective, a fresh set of eyes, and I either experiment with problems I'm working through using the arts. So say, a social ethical lens to understand a problem, or from a more technical design thinking perspective. So that's what I'm all about. And I've really enjoyed traveling, studying my master's in England last year, going to COP26 and learning all about how different European countries approach the SDGs. So yeah, really excited to have this chat. I've actually just returned to Australia after that year and a half abroad. So really passionate about bringing those, I guess, broader perspectives and ways of integrating knowledge back to Australia to help in our own efforts towards the SDGs.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. And it seems like it's a really good time, I guess, for us to catch up again. I mean, it always is. Anytime we'll catch up, so let me know. So, okay, let's start. So when we recorded last time, you were just about to set off, I think. And because that was quite a feat, given that it was 2021 traveling to the UK. So tell us, like, what you did over there and what your motivation was to go and study and what you actually studied, and then kind of what you've got out of those last 18 months.
Sure. So I guess coming out of COVID, I just finished my undergrad at Monash University. I was really passionate about the field of STEM, civil and transport engineering in particular, and I'd done some work looking into sustainable materials in road and rail and found it really exciting. But I suppose since my training wasn't in engineering and I was more of a social scientist, had a very maybe unique lens of how the social sciences could play a role in advancing innovation and gathering support for new sustainable technologies. And so I looked to try and find some sort of methodology or way of working that integrated the social into the engineering, and found humanitarian engineering. So I studied the first master's in that field in the world at Warwick University and was really grateful to have the support of the Victorian government Sir John Monash Scholarship to study there. So it was just such a fantastic experience, really. It was set in the countryside in the West Midlands in England. Lived on a farm for the course and we had sheep running around, and yeah, just such a nice, wholesome time. And there were about 20 people in the course, and I think that included representation from 12 countries. So all of the work, I suppose, floated around the SDGs from a health perspective, from an energy perspective, from a data perspective. And then people would be saying, oh, well, you know, in my country, this is how we handle this issue. Or, you know, the pandemic in my country really brought out these elements of, say, food security or other issues that we were shining a light on. So I think it was just really valuable from my perspective to get to hear so many different people, not only from different countries, but different educational backgrounds, all in a room together and all with this kind of fresh motivation to want to do something about the world they saw around them. So I really enjoyed that. And I suppose coming in from more of a perspective of wanting to integrate some of these methodologies into our own approaches to, say, transport engineering or STEM spending in general in Australia, it was really exciting doing that from a management perspective specifically. And I've got a lot out of it, really enjoyed the time there. And then I went on to do my dissertation on how drone tree planting can be understood through a socio-ecological systems perspective. So to, I suppose, wind back the jargon a little bit, essentially I was looking at how flying drones can plant trees. You know, it's a possibility, it's been done, it's technically possible, but how does that work when you look at existing forestry systems and community systems relating to environmental governance and restoration? And so I thought that would be a great case study for understanding, you know, how technology, sustainability, and that community piece could come together. So really, really enjoyed that. And obviously recommend, you know, to anyone who wants to study overseas, you just get such a fresh look on the problems you're working out that you can bring back to your own country afterwards.
Now, that's awesome. And I think it is a really what I found when I was traveling, when I did my Churchill Fellowship, obviously a bit different, is just because you're not at home, so you have you're not thinking about all those things that you have to think about and, you know, do whatever. You have time to think, you have time to, and you're kind of in holiday mode, travel mode. When I travel, I'm just a better human or something. Like, I'm just so excited about everything. Not better human, maybe like a more happier, your mind just opens because it has to, because you have to solve all these problems that you wouldn't have at home. Fun problems like, oh, where should I go today? Oh, how do I catch the train, in France or whatever? Or what do I do if I don't speak the language and my phone's going flat or whatever? Like, all these things that you have to think about. But then I think, living overseas, and I've only done it for a short stint, it does, I think your brain works differently and you're able to absorb. I found that I was able to just absorb a lot more because that was why I was there, and then bring that back to the Australian context or, wherever. And listening to other people bring it back to their context as well is just so fascinating. Just things you wouldn't even think about, that you wouldn't even think about thinking about, and it's just so, it's a really interesting experience. I'm keen to talk about all those things you just talked about, but I just want to circle back a little bit to humanitarian engineering. For those, there might be the first time people heard this term. So can you just give us a little bit of a 101 and and maybe the principle, the foundation of what humanitarian engineering is?
Sure. So the way I usually like to describe it is, imagine traditionally, you're a structural engineer, you're thinking, how do we get from, say, for a bridge from point A to point B? And the sort of questions you ask might be, what's the most effective way to get there? What's the safest way to get there? What can we replicate that's been done before and has worked? Whereas a humanitarian engineer might look at that problem of how do you get from point A to point B and ask a very different set of questions. So they might say, who's going on this journey and where are they going? And are they going into a new community? Are those communities connected? And then the actual construction itself, is this a chance to try something new, to test some sustainable innovation? Is it a way to bring people together to help local employment? It's really, I guess, a way of broadening the scope of the problem on paper you think you're solving and looking at defining that on a community level and being able to integrate and pull in all those different factors that investment in engineering can foreseeably, stimulate beyond the project itself.
Yeah, cool. I like that as asking a different set of questions because, we need the technical elements, of course, and we need the bridges to be safe and, all those type of things as well. But then bringing in that different lens of, why are we actually building a bridge? Is that the thing that we need? Because, engineers connect communities, they do all these things, they ensure we have safe water, clean water, all those type of things as well. But then it's just okay, well, what are those other questions that we need to ask? Because there's so many different ways to do things these days and new things are coming up and whatever. And sometimes it just takes a moment to ask the right, a different set of questions, which I really like.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose being a relatively new field, it's something that's grown out of the field of international aid. So if people can imagine, projects dealing with famine or lack of access to electricity, when you picture someone going into that context, I suppose you can see that they're not just having to say, install a water pump. It's about, will the community use that? Does the community want that? How are they going to, have a sense of ownership over time? How can they be involved? And you're often in very resource poor settings. Sometimes there's social conflict. And so these kind of methodologies and management tools that have come out of some quite extreme environments, I think, are particularly pertinent to even, developed cities and countries that are still trying to figure out how exactly they're going to pull all those strings together in our efforts towards mitigating climate change and supporting all the other SDGs.
Yeah, absolutely. And thinking about that ownership piece, it's like, do we know how to maintain this properly? And do we have those skills and resources? Or, is that actually taking away from something else that, is really important or whatever? Yeah, I did a little bit of work when I was in Nepal around this, and I probably talked about this last time I was on the podcast. And it was like, Yeah, there's so many different questions. You have to have somebody thinking about that. Otherwise, yeah, it's just, you know, you put your Western, you come in and with your big Western hat on, basically, and just go, oh, well, you don't have lighting in the school. Okay, cool. Well, you'll need solar panels on the roof here or whatever. But, you know, there's so many other things that maybe not, you know, on the priority list of how that works. And, you know, thinking about, yeah, maybe it is, yeah, there's so many different solutions, but you have to work in with the community to be able to do it. Because it can't take, if you're providing an oven or something, okay, that might work better, but does it take longer? Is the person that has to, does it take them longer to be able to use it or prepare for it and all those type of things as well? And I think that's really important as we move forward in all kind of contexts. You know, like you said, thinking about those more kind of extreme context, but then taking those principles and then spreading that out to a whole range of different things that we do.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what you touched on initially as well around, you know, coming in as an outsider and perhaps thinking you know what's best for people, that's something that I suppose traditionally was quite present in the field of international aid, and something I guess there's a big movement in wanting to address through more community-led project design in general. So there's a lot of really interesting case studies. For example, there's, you know, a story of outsiders coming into a village and saying, you know, these people have to walk a whole hour to get water every day. How awful, how unbelievable. We're going to install a well so they can access water and it's going to improve everyone's standard of living. You know, just kind of a logical approach, well-intended approach. But then coming back years after it was installed, the well had kind of become really run down. People weren't using it. People weren't taking care of it. And they were just so confused. And so they asked the community, you know, why has this happened? Why aren't you invested in using this and taking care of this? And they said, well, the 2 hours that the kids went to fetch the water every day was when we got all of our work done, all of our housework, all of the work on the land. And when the kids were around for the whole day, like, we became so unproductive, we couldn't get what we needed done. It was so frustrating. And we just wished it was never here. We would have wanted to use the help or the money for something else that was more important to us and we felt we actually needed. And I think it's so important, you know, going from, say, even a small locality like that to going to some of the big picture things, even in Australia, we really need to be tuned in to what communities want and how we can best utilize our funding to address those things that communities have identified for themselves.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think, you know, thinking about it from a smart community perspective, obviously we talk about technology and data and all those type of things, but we know that they are the enablers. It's actually about a whole different approach and thinking from a community perspective. Not even just thinking from a community perspective, actually engaging and finding out what the community wants and needs. And like you said, like that priority list that they have in their minds, or, you know, I'm just thinking when you were talking about the water, it's like, okay, yeah, we want that. We've got this solution that we can, like, you know, place in here, but actually what's number one on the priority list and why? And maybe there's different, you know, might not be technology, might be different things that you could do to actually assist with that. And I just think the more that we do that, then the better we can, I guess, serve the communities in wherever, you know, wherever they end up, wherever they happen to be. But then it's actually the process as well. It's not just the outcome. Because if we change that process and then we learn from that and people get used to, oh, well, it's a co-design or whatever, yeah, there are buzzy terms, but do you know what I mean? It's actually like, you know, listening to the community and then acting on that as well. Because if you don't, you just go, oh, the community told us we wanted a well. Oh, surprise, we've got this solution. Like, you know, you do engagement for the sake of engagement. That just doesn't, you know, and then the community, you won't hear from the community again because you've lost all trust. And I think that's really key in all those projects that we're doing from a smart community perspective as well, or thinking about that from a concept perspective. I just think, like, once we, yeah, it's something that's really important as we move forward in this space. And I think that's what we're seeing the space mature into, which is really, I guess, good to see. But then it's like, yeah, now the action, it needs to come behind it too.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think bringing in those different disciplines that you were talking about as well, and even just your background, and bringing in those different mindsets and contexts and experiences is really key. But I forgot to ask you, let's go back to the very beginning. And what is a smart community to you?
To me, I suppose looking at the smart aspect, you know, like a smart city, you think about data, machine learning, having the ability to have more insights than we've ever had before into how cities or areas function. So, you know, satellite data, sensors, being able to understand how buildings are utilized and all this great information that we can use to our effect to understand the flow of people, the flow of money, the flow of information. But then when I think of the term smart communities, it shifts the focus from being at that high level, what's possible, what's available in a big data sense, down to more of a empowered perspective of how do we direct information to address specific things identified within those areas. So similar to what we were talking about before, I think of a smart community as something that's very participatory. It's something where communities are empowered to increase their own levels of education, health, and connectivity. And I suppose the smart community concept, it really makes me imagine, I suppose, how will we apply all this information? Will we use it to the effect to help, you know, people, or will it help businesses, or you know, what level are we going to see these machine learning insights utilized to support? And I think that obviously it's kind of anyone's game at the moment. There's so much changing so quickly. And even in the past year, all of the new tools available to the average person are just astounding, really. But I really like how you've grounded that that term. And I think it represents a vision for where we want to go in a way that's much more inclusive and enabling than a smart city, say, more broadly.
Yeah, I mean, I agree, because it was, yeah, definitely something I was really keen on. And, you know, I kept saying the term smart city, but I'm like, oh, it doesn't connect with community and no one knows what this is. And, you know, whether the term's right now or not, but it's like you can connect with it. The community can connect with it because people know what a community is, and it shifts that focus to the people. And I think it's really interesting, like you said, in the last year, last year in particular, it seems like there's more and more tools at people's fingertips. And, you know, there's lots of people scared, and things have happened that, you know, data breaches and all these type of things are happening. And I think the thing is, they were happening. There's stuff happening before. It's just, now it's a bit more high profile. Everyone's got the platforms at their fingertips as well. But I think in the sense we want people to be asking those questions and questioning the tools as well. Like, don't just like, oh, well, now we've got this thing, let's just use this. But it's like, well, no, these tools don't just come out of nowhere. They're like, technology is a product of human creativity, is what Laura Filano said on the podcast way back when I first started. And I just thought, because creativity is not always good, right? Like, people have to be creative to do pretty bad things as well. And I just think, like, in terms of technology, you have to be pretty creative if you were, I don't know, trying to pull off some kind of heist or something like that, for sure. But I think it's what is good is that people are being exposed to it and then being aware, so then they can ask questions about it. And I think, but my biggest concern, I suppose, and why we, you know, work in the smart community space is because we want governments and institutions and people, these institutional or like kind of foundational things that keep us running and safe and alive and all those type of things. We need people to be aware so then we can, you know, not go down a track where we're just, you know, have this dystopian future or whatever the case is. And I think, yeah, it is about asking the right questions as we move along, but then also bringing it to people's awareness. And I was thinking about, you know, last conversation around art and the community, and yeah, was keen to, I guess, since we had that conversation, obviously you've been overseas, but what are some of the other things that you've been up to or concepts you've kind of expanded on over that time?
Since we spoke last, one of the areas I've been quite active in is endometriosis advocacy. So I think it might have even been a month before or after the podcast, I got my diagnosis with endo. And it's a chronic pain illness that affects 1 in 9 women. And more broadly, it affects all people with uteruses, but the statistics that are there are for women at the moment. And I suppose a little bit like I said earlier, when I've got a problem, I like to attack it from a lot of different angles. So as a social scientist, I was thinking, you know, how can, say, the diagnosis time for an illness that's so pervasive in people's lives be 7 years? And why aren't conversations happening, whether it's in schools, in families, in GP offices, you know, even more structurally in government? Why is that happening? And I found it so, I suppose, impossible to tackle from that perspective, because there were so many communication blockers and so many things along every step of the journey that really prevent people from getting the help they need. So I decided to take more of an art lens for this particular problem. And I suppose since the symptoms are quite taboo and can be related to menstruation, that was, I guess, the initial point where I felt that communication breakdowns were happening. So I did a photography series using robotics to try and take that image of pain outside of the body and to show what the sensations were like. So I guess the subjective thing about endo is it's like, you know, how much pain with your period is too much pain? When is it a problem? And, you know, is it really that bad? So I was trying to add a bit more nuance to the conversation around pulling or twisting or stabbing. And I ran workshops with different patients through art approaches to understand how they identified and defined their pain in those kind of non-tangible action type ways. And I took that to France. I ended up becoming a laureate of the Australian French Association for Innovation and Research. So essentially the embassy for France in Australia supported me to go over there and do a fashion art residency. So I kind of embroidered these stories onto hospital gowns and used the robotics works to frame a conversation in a new place. And like you were saying earlier, when you travel, you see things you never would have noticed at home. And I think that contrast between what are the social taboos in France? How does diagnosis happen there? What's different culturally? How does art function in these conversations? And I think that really enabled me to reflect on what specifically was going on in Australia and how I could help. So I even ended up running the inaugural Australia-France Endometriosis Forum and brought together kind of everyone I felt should be part of the conversation. So GPs, researchers, nurses, patients, people in the community involved in policy. And we used all the artworks I'd created through these community workshops, my own practice, to suppose shape a new language for the conversation. And that's something I've been really passionate about furthering through the exhibitions I've been involved in and my talks and all that. So actually really excited to bring that exhibition to Australia in a couple months. It'll be at Manningham Art Gallery in March.
Oh, that's amazing. I'll have to come and see it. Yeah, I was following along and it's, yeah, love it. I think you're so right. I've got some friends who've been diagnosed, but yeah, it took years. And like you said, it was like, it's this kind of, you know, the taboos and things like that. And I haven't looked at all of the research, but just thinking about from, you know, talking to my friends, it's, you know, that social kind of pressure to just get on with it when you've got your period or whatever, like just, you know, don't complain, you know, maybe take some Panadol, but just get on with it. And, you know, oh, well, everyone's got cramps. So, you know, what is that like? But it's so interesting because like, and how much it affects people's, I guess, ability to, you know, continue in the workforce, those type of things. Like one of my friends suffered every day for, you know, years, and she ran her own business. So she had to keep going essentially, but just was not getting the diagnosis or the treatment that she needed. And then eventually when she did, then, you know, she was then able to, she was in the art space actually. And then just kind of, I don't know, liberated out of this thing that was causing that chronic pain. And yeah, it's crazy that it took that long. And you think about some of, you know, some of the other diseases and things that are quite well known and, you know, that we test for, and that, you know, if you say you've got that or you've got these symptoms, then you would go down a path of diagnosis. Whereas this was just, you know, how someone can suffer for so long and not get any kind of relief until, and really you have to advocate for yourself as well. And I think that's something that we're still building as a group of people and that type of thing. And I think, yeah, I love that, like, bringing that different lens to it, like you said, and that you've got this big, wicked, hairy problem, essentially, and what can we use to attack with it, and picking, you know, those tools out of your tool belt, essentially, and art, the technology, you know, you've got your data as well. And that's, like, for me, that's a perfect kind of smart city or smart community approach, rather, and just thinking about that from a, you know, maybe it's not about where we live and play, but it affects people's quality of life, right? And we're all people at the end of the day. So no, well done. It's really great. I love it.
Thank you. Yeah, I suppose the way I like to think of problems that I encounter, whether it's something at work or something in life, I guess I try to think, whose problem is this? You know, what community am I a part of? And how can I do something, connect people, share something to help that community? And I suppose thinking beyond myself, and I was going through the surgery and the long recovery process, you know, there are a lot of questions there, like, how does this affect our economy and our workforce in Australia? You know, if one
Absolutely.
In women have these really severe, you know, sometimes even paralyzing levels of pain and, you know, vomiting and not being able to function as a human for a few days, and then it's all just so hidden, which is, yeah, something really unfortunate. But I suppose over the past few years, we've got our national endo strategy now, and there's a bit of innovation happening. Could move faster, but yeah, I think it's something everyone deserves to know about and to hear about, even though it's not, you know, it's not super fun being the poster child for something, you know, negative or sad, or that might make people cringe or uncomfortable. But I just wish someone had of kind of done that for me sometime, you know, in the 7 years I was experiencing my symptoms, so that I would have known what support I had. So yeah, I think a smart community, to tie it back, is something where every person's problem is the community's problem.
No, I think that's so true. And you're right, like, it's that, you know, awareness leads to focus, which then leads to action. And whether that's at a community level, which is what we're talking about here, but then also from a individual level, like, if you were aware that these were symptoms, you then would focus on it, and then you would take action based on that information that you had, or you get more information. I think that's really key. And sometimes, you know, people might go, oh, well, you know, it's just a campaign, or it's just this or that, but that awareness then leads to the focus, which then leads to action. And I think that's really important. And I guess you're right, like, it does make some people feel really uncomfortable, but it still doesn't mean it's not happening in the world. There's lots of things that are, you know, uncomfortable, and sometimes we need to talk about them. Well, a lot of the time we need to talk about them, but also just, yeah, it's interesting. It's just like this, even like one of my friends who did the Churchill Fellowship, she did public toilets, and, you know, even something that we all use every day was still a bit of a, like, what are the taboos around public toilets? And a lot of, like, some of the stuff was around menstruation and things like that as well. And yeah, just really fascinating, the kind of conversations that she had, but then at what level makes people feel uncomfortable. But it is, like, such a huge issue, sanitation around the world and that type of thing. So yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah.
So, okay, let's zoom to the future now. Thanks so much for sharing that. And I guess if you really don't know what endometriosis is, I would suggest you Google it and find out. But it's, yeah, it is, like I said, 1 in 9 women, and affecting more people than that as well. Yeah, I think it's a really worthy cause to just, you know, again, raise awareness so then people can take action on it as well. Cool. I feel like I'm like, I don't know, at the end of some kind of like TV show on endometriosis. But no, I think it's great. I think I love talking about so like different things on this podcast as well, because it's really important. And the fact that, you know, we bring in all those different pieces as we try and solve problems. So let's move to the future now. What do you think the emerging trends that people aren't talking about enough are?
Something that I think people are talking about, but I'm not completely tuned into yet, but I think is interesting, is the role of machine learning in art and how that influences, I guess, the world of work more broadly. So even just myself in the past month or so, seeing how ChatGPT and other resources, even like DALL-E for artists, have just completely shook everything up. And so far, you know, it's been in a great way. But say, for example, in Melbourne, we've got Federation Square, which is right near Flinders Street Station. And I had a project creating an art film for display on that screen. And not only did I have artificial intelligence help me generate the actual subject matter, but I had it help me generate the ideas. So I was going from ChatGPT saying, come up with a concept that links this, 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 come up with a brief that I can put into another AI to generate images, and then taking that, copying it. So I almost became like the creative director of a little team of AIs, which is super trippy. And even, you know, with work and different elements of what I do, I've been using it just so much. And I think even, you know, every day, people, teachers, people writing, you know, emails, you know, there's so many contexts, I suppose, it comes into, but it does make me really wonder, like in a knowledge economy, you know, if we become so hyper effective, it just completely changes how we spend our time, because it is coming on so quickly. It really makes me want to ask more about what else do we do with the time we have left.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting one. And like, I think we are in a time of, you know, hyper change and rapid change, as we said, we, you know, will continue to be in that, and then using those tools at our fingertips, but then questioning them as well, I think is really important. But then, yeah, buying back leisure time, which I think, you know, before it's like, okay, we're actually doing much of the same. We're working, you know, our 40-hour weeks, we're getting our salary. Most people do that. Although, you know, we all work. And yeah, but then it's like, at what point is it like, oh, well, my toolkit that I've curated, my curated toolkit does this work that is, you know, robust and whatever else and all the things and quality. What else can I do then with my time if I'm still able to get, like, a, you know, like you said, the economy, like if I can still get my same salary or whatever, but then I've actually got 20 hours back in my week or whatever the case is. Again, do we just become more and more productive, so then we just continue to burn out? And I think it's a societal permission, or it's a norm, or it's a something. You know, we all know there's different work ethics all around the world, or different cultures in work. So what will that next wave be? And I always talk about buying back leisure time, but then you have to give yourself permission, but then also, you know, the rest of the cultural permission as well to actually, yeah, spend time in different ways. Like, is it volunteering, or is it creativity in a different sense, or is it whatever the case is it you can spend more time with your family or whatever? There's so many different things that I think it will be in the next kind of 5 to 10 years or more beyond that as well. What are those little shifts that are going to change?
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess being in the arts, I've felt it really come, you know, bring a wave through my art practice. And I suppose liking to use technology as part of my work, I've always pursued efficiency, you know, the best way to express an idea, the most effective way to get an exhibition up on the wall, those sort of things. But it does make me think, because I have found that I've had more time too. You know, you see parents, grandparents retiring and not necessarily knowing what to do with that time. And even in some cases, getting back on the treadmill because they don't know how to stop. And I think, I suppose, as the world of work has been really shaken up. And when I say the world of work, I mean more in a knowledge economy sense. Yeah, how can we, I suppose, better ourselves, better our communities in that time? And is that something we're going to be striving towards as more and more gets automated, or will it be progress for the sense of progress? And as you said, you know, stay on the treadmill, burn out and keep going, or will we use it to radically change the role that I guess people have in how engaged they are in their communities, how connected they are? And I really hope that that's something that people will lead towards rather than more time for Netflix, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, no, I agree. No, it's fascinating, I guess. Yeah, and it's happening before our eyes. That's not necessarily like, yeah, we can see it. It's not like, oh, I can imagine that this will be what it's like, but it's like, no, it's happening right now as we're going along. Yeah, it's going to be an interesting time the next few years.
Really?
Yeah, I think that's a great way to finish off this episode. Thank you so much, Jess, for coming onto the podcast again. I've loved this conversation, and I look forward to having more. I will be in Melbourne sometime soon, so I'll let you know. We might be able to catch up.
Yeah. That would be lovely.
Well, Jess, thanks so much for coming on the podcast again. Just one last question. How can people connect with you?
I have LinkedIn, so Jessica Coldry, and I also have my art website and portfolio, jesscoldry.com. So I'm sure you'll drop the spelling and everything in the episode.
We will.
Great. Well, thanks so much for having me, Zoe.
Thanks. I look forward to our next conversation, and hopefully we can see each other in 3D soon.
Sounds thanks, good.
Jess. Thanks, Zoe. Bye.
Are you looking for an engaging speaker, MC, or facilitator for your next big event? Then we've got you covered. Zoe is a go-to speaker, MC, and conversation facilitator with a difference. She's a master at simplifying the complex and making connections you might never see. Book Zoe for your next event. Email hello@mysmart.community or head over to her speaker page, www.mysmart.community/speaking.
Thanks so much for listening to the Smart Community Podcast. Show notes for this episode and all other episodes are available on our website, mysmart.community/podcast. If you have any questions for us or any of our guests, you can email hello@mysmart.community. You can also find us on the socials. We are on LinkedIn and Twitter @smartcomhq. That's com with two M's. If you are enjoying the podcast, please hit subscribe so you never miss an episode. And we would love for you to leave us a rating and review at wherever you listen. This really helps us reach more ears and eyes, so thank you for your support. As always, we hope you enjoyed listening to this episode as much as we enjoyed making it.
The Smart Community Podcast is what you're looking for.